for the next several weeks are going to focus on some things having to do with remembering. There ought to be things in our lives that help us remember. Not just who we are things that are special to us in a personal family way, but help us remember on a much more eternal spiritual level as well. And as we finished up our study last week of the part of our shadow of good things to come that dealt with the priesthood and the high priest, I told you then, I think, that we're going to begin today a study of the celebrations or the Feast of Israel. Now, normally, none of us would be too excited if I said, today we're going to study the holidays they have in India. We'd probably say, who cares? Or what does that have to do with us? Or why is that of some spiritual significance to us? And you'd be right. Even if we were to talk about the celebrations we have as a nation, that only has very limited appeal or application to anything spiritual. We probably could pull some kind of lesson out of Thanksgiving, and we recognize with Christmas and Easter there was supposed to be some spiritual lesson there at the root of it to start with, but many of our other holidays are strictly national and have to do with historical things or personal things, whether it's Mother's Day or the 4th of July or Labor Day or whatever it may be, Columbus Day. But when we start talking about the holidays that the Jewish people kept, we need to realize that's a very different matter. A very different matter. I've been trying to think of different ways to illustrate why this is so important to us as we've been moving through this study of the shadow of good things to come. That expression comes out of Hebrews chapter 10, where the writer, after having talked about the priesthood, having talked about the tabernacle and the temple, talked about the animal sacrifices that were all of those things part of the Old Testament and the things that the Jews from Moses down to Jesus had practiced and had continually made application between the old priesthood and Jesus as a priest, between the old sacrifices and Jesus as a sacrifice, between the old tabernacle and Jesus being in heaven before the very throne of God. He then starts chapter 10 by saying all of these things were but a shadow of the good things to come. So he wanted his readers and us to understand there is spiritual significance in those things. But now we're moving away from those to talk about something else that the Jewish people received under Moses, and that were practiced right down through the days of Jesus, that also had spiritual significance. And yet, as little as we may know about the tabernacle, as little as we may know about the priesthood in the Old Testament, as little as we may understand or know about the sacrifices, I suspect that we know even less as a people about the holidays they kept and what was so important about them. That's our loss. That's something that keeps us from appreciating not just what they were about and what God was doing, but what we ought to be about. No, I'm not advocating that we start celebrating the Passover or that we start celebrating Pentecost or that we start celebrating the Day of Atonement. We already celebrate all those things in their fulfillment. But I think perhaps unless we appreciate the history behind them, we don't even celebrate them the way we should. Certainly people in our country bemoan the fact that historically, people who don't really understand what happened on the 4th of July can't celebrate it like they ought to. Just having a picnic and a day off is not really honoring what happened on the 4th of July. The same is true of a day that probably even gets less attention and yet is a national holiday, Labor Day. understanding what's behind that day and why that was first made a national holiday for us is the only way to really appreciate it. It's not just an extended weekend. It's not just an extra day off from work so we can have 3 days off in a row instead of only Saturday and Sunday. There's something very significant behind that. How much more might that be true when we start talking about some holidays that were celebrated in the Bible? In the book of Leviticus, chapter 23, we're going to be visiting that chapter quite a bit over the next 2 or 3 weeks as we talk about this part of our study. God says this. This is Leviticus 23. This is still while they're gathered at Mount Sinai. They get it to Mount Sinai about Exodus chapter 18, I guess it is, and 19 is where God begins to speak to the people and speak to Moses. And the book of Leviticus then is just an extension of what God is saying in the book of Exodus to them, where God is detailing all the different laws, commandments, practices, interactions between people and so forth. And this chapter 23 has detailed all of the major celebrations they were to participate in. It begins with this statement in verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, these are my appointed feast, the appointed feast of the Lord, which you are to proclaim as sacred assemblies." Okay, there's several things right away we're hearing God saying as He's speaking to Moses and He's to speak to the people and lay this down as law for them. First of all, we find out it's from God. But more than just from God, God even says, these are my appointed feast. We will eventually hear that the Jewish people kept other festivals and celebrations in addition to these that God gives. But these are God's. They keep these because they are connected to God. And God ordained that they be kept. Secondly, it says not only that they're my appointed feast, but we even have that expression there, appointed feast. Now, we tend to think of the word feast today as something like a banquet, a big gathering where there's going to be lots of food and that's going to be the focus of what's going on. Yeah, somebody may give a speech or an award might be given out or something, but the food's the important stuff. That's not the concept here. In fact, feast is probably not even the best word to translate it, but it's as, probably as good as any other we have in the English language. The Hebrew word, so I've been told, and I've never studied Hebrew, except just very informally, the actual Hebrew word is ha-mo-adin, or mo-adin. And it literally means appointed times. It really doesn't have in it even our modern concept of feast at all. Some of these feasts had no food attached to them at all. And so they were not feast at all in the sense of food. They were, instead, God is saying, these are my appointed times. He says that twice. These are my appointed times. That's what the word mo'adin or mo'adim meant in the Hebrew. And then God says that they were to be sacred gathering, sacred assemblies. In other words, there's a religious, a spiritual significance to them. They were not primarily patriotic. They were not primarily personal. They were not primarily nationalistic. They were sacred, set apart, holy. That's the idea behind them. God instituted a great many ceremonies, celebrations, festivals, and yes, real feasts even, under the old law. And those different celebrations and ceremonies and festivals had one of two purposes, and occasionally both. When God appointed these, He had one or the other or both intentions in appointing them. They were either to remember specific events in order to help them reflect on how much they relied on God or needed to rely on Him, or else they were celebrations of God's blessings, which also reminded them that they depended on God. The common thread in both of those is their dependence on and need of God. There were these seven major feasts, if you look now with me in Leviticus 23, starting down in verse 4, I use a Bible, and maybe you do too, that actually breaks things up into not paragraphs, but into sections. And so my translation here actually adds some things that aren't in the original text as headings over different sections, so I can see very clearly all seven of the feasts that are named. There was the Passover feast in verse 4, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We're going to use that word feast, even though the implication might be different from the way we use that word today. And then in verse 9, there was a Feast of the First Fruits. And then down in verse 15, the Feast of Weeks, that's now four, Passover, Unleavened Bread, First Fruits, and Weeks. And then down in verse 23, he talks about the Feast of Trumpets. In verse 26, the Day of Atonement. And in verse 33, the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, probably none of those, except maybe Passover, really rings very clear to us as to what it's all about. But I hope we can change all of that as we together examine these. But notice before he even talks about the feasts themselves, he starts chapter 23 in verse 3 by talking about the Sabbath. So God also saw their weekly observation of the Sabbath day as a sacred assembly, an appointed time from Him. Certainly it was actually one of the Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. It was intended by God to remind them every week how they depended on Him. And they relied on Him. But there were also other celebrations. I won't give you the scriptures for them. I'll just mention them in passing. And they were also from God. In addition to the weekly Sabbath and these seven major holidays or holy days or holy times that are here in Leviticus 23, they also observe the monthly new moon celebration. At the new moon, at the beginning of every month, they had a special time. The Jewish calendar was based on the moon. Their months were always 28 days long. It began at new moon, and it ended when it returned to the day before new moon. And then their new month would begin. And so all of their months were exactly 28 days long. As a result of that, their year was a little different than ours. Our year has 365 days in it, except every fourth year we have 366 for leap year. That indicates that, you know, even our calendar has to make some adjustments from time to time to make things work out right. But their year was based upon 12 28-day months. That means that every third or fourth year they had to have an extra month to catch back up. Or eventually, their first month of the year would be have moved all the way around through the year and through the seasons. But nevertheless, so that was how they compensated for that. We do it with a leap year, at one day every 4 years. They did it with an extra month every third or fourth year. But at the beginning of every month, they had the new moon celebration. In addition to that, every seventh year was a Sabbath year. And so in that one year, some things were done a little differently. If someone, as we were looking at in Bible class this morning, a lady comes to Elisha the prophet and says, "My husband has died. When he died, we had debt and we had no way to pay it. And so our creditor wants to take my two sons and turn them into his indentured servants to pay the debt." Under Jewish law, in the Sabbath year, everybody was set free. If your debt hadn't been paid by then, too bad. You can't keep these people in your service anymore. They are free to go home and be free people again. That was the Sabbath year, every seventh year. And then every 49th or 50th, it's not clear to me from the way the text reads and how the practice was actually done, but every seven Sabbath years, they had a Jubilee year. And that was the year of Jubilee, in which, again, things were done a little differently than were done the other times. And now, not only are indentured servants set free, but if someone, because of debt or other reasons, had to actually sell their family property to pay debt or to meet their needs, in the year of Jubilee, that property reverted back to the original owners and the original families. And the law even made it very clear that if a man is buying your property and you're having to sell it because of debt, or even if you're selling it for any other reason, it didn't make any difference. You need to understand that if it's only three more years until the year of Jubilee, you're only going to have that property 3 years before it has to revert back to the family who first received it when they came into the promised land under Joshua. And so they celebrated Sabbath every week, seven major feast times every year, a new moon festival, the first of every month, and then Sabbath years and years of Jubilee. And then added to that gradually were some other things that God did not command, but we find them practicing, and I would assume God must have in some way at least accepted it, even though he didn't require it of them. Eventually, they will start celebrating a feast called the Feast of Purim. If you know the story in the book of Esther in the Old Testament, how while some of the Jewish people are being held in captive in Assyria, the king takes among his many wives, he takes a wife from among the Hebrew women, a woman by the name of Esther. And all the events that happened there, can't tell the whole story this morning, but eventually God has to rescue the people from death. And he uses Esther and her uncle to save the people. And after that, the Jewish people started celebrating the Feast of Purim, which celebrated the deliverance from God that came in the days of Esther. And then in about 200 B.C., 200 years before Jesus was born roughly, the Jewish nation was subjugated to a series of kings, Epiphanes and so forth, from up in Syria, not Assyria, but from Syria to their north. And this king was very brutal. He was very sacrilegious. And in order to try to break the spirit of the Jewish people, he actually not only conquered them, but he then invaded Jerusalem and he marched himself and some of his soldiers into the temple itself, which was sacrilegious because only the priests were supposed to be there. And he actually took a pig, which, of course, the pig was an unclean animal, and had it sacrificed on the high altar in mockery of the Jewish religion. And that began a revolt among the Jews, a rebellion against his his rule over them that eventually led to the Maccabees, these group of priests who became soldiers and rebels and led an uprising that eventually drove the Syrian king and his armies out of there, and they established their independence for a period of maybe 100 years or so. And so the Jews started celebrating something they called Hanukkah. And we still hear that today. Hanukkah celebrated when they finally drove the Syrians out and the priests, the Maccabees and others, were finally able to come in and purify the temple and rededicate it to God again. We even find Jesus celebrating Hanukkah in the New Testament. We don't find that word, but in John chapter 10, we find Jesus was up at Jerusalem and at the temple during the feast of dedication, it says. That was Hanukkah. And so the Jews had all these many different holidays and feasts they celebrated in addition to the seven that we're going to focus on. But we do want to focus on the seven. And I ask the question, which hopefully part of it's already self-evident by the theme we have in all this. Why? Why would we want to look at these seven major feasts of the Jews? Why would we care if they kept Passover or kept something called the Feast of Unleavened Bread or especially something called the Feast of Trumpets? I mean, why do you have a celebration about trumpets? Number one, two major reasons. Here's the first reason. Because they were a shadow of good things to come. Not only do we have our passage there in Hebrews chapter 10 that we've read a number of times, but we also have this passage that Don read to us this morning at the beginning. Call your attention to that again in the book of Colossians and in chapter 2. Realize Paul is writing to Christians in Colossae. Almost all of them were Gentile. They were not Jewish. But there were some Jewish people going around, and some of them were Christians and probably some of them were not. But they were going around following Paul almost to the churches he was establishing. And they were going into those churches and telling them, now you realize that unless you start keeping the Jewish customs, you can't really be pleasing to God. It's not enough just to believe in Christ and become disciples of His and be baptized and dedicate your life to Him as your Lord. They were coming in and saying, you also need to be circumcised. You need to keep the Sabbath days. You need to keep the holy days, the Passover, the unleavened bread, the Feast of Weeks, all of these. That's what these people were doing. And now God had already settled that once and for all back in Acts chapter 15. That the Gentiles did not need to keep the Old Testament law. And so when Paul's writing to the Christians in Colossae, since he was last there, some people have come in and disturbed them with these false teachings. And so in writing to them, he says to them in Colossians 2:16 and 17, therefore do not let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink. They were trying to force off on them their dietary laws under the law of Moses, where there were things like pigs that were unclean and other things that were clean and edible, and they had to go through certain ceremonies even before they could eat them and so forth. So he says, don't let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink, or with regard to a religious festival, that would be the holy days, a new moon celebration, their monthly celebration, or a Sabbath day, their weekly celebration. He covers all three of them right there, the three major categories. Their holy times, their appointed times, their monthly time, their new moon, and their weekly time, their Sabbath day. So Paul said, don't let anyone judge you, and he means by that, judge as to whether you're right with God or not, based upon whether you keep these things. Why, Paul? He says, these are a shadow of the things that were to come. The reality, however, is found in Christ. Now, in the verses just before this, he's already told them that when Christ died on the cross, God nailed that old law to the cross with him. That doesn't mean that the old law was a bad thing. It just means its use was at an end. The reality that it all foreshadowed has now come. And then drawing out of that, Paul says what's in these two verses here. When Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 17, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them. I have come to fulfill them." Jesus is telling them that all of those things back there were just a foreshadowing, a premonition of what God was going to do in Him. And so the first reason we want to study these feasts is because they are the shadow. We should be able to see Him in them. Any of you ever been fascinated by these pictures that you can find? Sometimes they're just drawings, other times might be paintings. And even as a child, I was exposed to them, where that when you first look at the picture, there's a picture there. You can see it, whatever it may be. But then you're told, or it's pointed out to you, that within that picture are all sorts of other pictures that are not immediately obvious right away. And so the game is that you're told that in this big picture are actually 7 or 13 or ever how many other little pictures. And maybe they even tell you. I know even Natty, my granddaughter's, already has a book that somebody's given her, probably her parents bought for her even, that they'll have a picture there and it said, "Can you see the book?" Well, at first you don't see a book anywhere in that picture, but if you look and look, finally you see it sort of worked into the design of something else. You understand the kind of the game I'm talking about now, the kind of pictures? And then there's some very elaborate, beautiful ones. I know I've seen some done of the American West and especially the American Indian and so forth. They'll have these beautiful big pictures. And then all of a sudden you're told that in that picture is 7 horses or something. And yet it looks like a picture of an Indian. And you look and look and gradually see them. That is how the Old Testament law was. At first, you just see what you're reading. But now you're told, in there are all these pictures of something else. And Jesus says they're pictures of Him. So that's the first reason we want to study these. The second reason is for the same reason God had them keep those holy days in the first place, other than preparing them for the coming of Christ. Because they were to remind them regularly and consistently of their dependence on Him. And we need to be reminded of that too. We just finished our communion. Yes, that reminds us of what happened for us almost 2,000 years ago on a hill outside of Jerusalem. But it's more than that. It's a reminder to us of why that's important to us. Not just what happened, but why it's important. It's to remind us. It's to help us remember. That's why Jesus said when He instituted it, "Do this in remembrance of Me." In Deuteronomy, as Moses is, the book of Deuteronomy is essentially Moses' last messages to the people. He's about to die. They're about to go under the leadership of Joshua and prepare to go into the land of promise that Moses has been leading them toward for all these many years. But as he's preparing them for that over several days or maybe several weeks, he gives several messages to them, almost like sermons in some ways. And those have been collected into this book of Deuteronomy. But he says in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and in verse 10, he warns them of something they are going to have a tendency to fall into. Because it's a human tendency. It's not a Jewish tendency. It's a human tendency. It's something we can fall into. He says in Deuteronomy 8 and verse 10, when you have eaten and are satisfied, he's talking about when they go into the land, conquer it, settle down, get what they came there for. When you have eaten and are satisfied, praise the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. Be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God, failing to observe his commands, his laws, and his decrees that I'm giving you this day. Otherwise, when you eat and are satisfied, when you build fine houses and settle down, and when your herds and flocks grow large and your silver and gold increase and all you have is multiplied, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. He led you through the vast and dreadful desert, that thirsty and waterless land with its venomous snakes and scorpions. He brought you water out of hard rock. He gave you manna to eat in the desert, something your fathers had never known, to humble and to test you so that in the end it might go well with you. You may say to yourself, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me. But remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you the ability to produce wealth and so confirms His covenant which He swore to your forefathers as it is today. If you ever forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and worship and bow down to them, I testify against you today that you will surely be destroyed. Moses tells them they need to remember. But those were not just empty words. There was teeth behind them, and they were given all these opportunities regularly to remember him with. And so the two reasons we want to study these festivals, these feasts, is because, first of all, they have pictures of Christ in them. Intentionally so. Designed so by God. But secondly, to, just like they were, to remember that we depend on God, just like they did. Okay, so very briefly, what were these seven major feasts? If we go back there to Leviticus 23, we saw the names of them, or at least how they're known by in one form. They sometimes have more than one name. But really, what were they all about? Well, beyond the Sabbath day, which was in Leviticus 23:3, starting in verse 4 of Leviticus 23, he mentions the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread and then the Day of the First Fruits, or the Feast of the First Fruits. I mentioned those three together because they were together. In their calendar, they celebrated Passover on the 14th and 15th day of their first month. They marked their calendar from when they left Egypt. That began their year. It took them, apparently, some time to get to Sinai and so forth, and we'll talk about that eventually, but this time when God says, I'm going to deliver you out of Egypt, that's when they began to mark themselves as God's people again, and so that marked their year. And on the 14th and 15th day of that first month, they celebrated a recreation of what had happened in Egypt, a Passover. Families gather, a lamb is killed, it's roasted and cooked, and they eat together. And the smallest child in the family, who's old enough to talk, at one point is nudged by one of his elders. And then he's supposed to say, Dad, why do we do this? And then his father tells a story of how God had delivered his people out of Egypt. But immediately after they celebrate that Passover in imitation of what had happened back in Egypt, they then move immediately into something else that happened back in Egypt. And that is, that same night, the Pharaoh declares, get out of my land. And so in haste, they pack what they have and take what they have and start to leave Egypt. And they don't even have enough time to prepare bread with yeast in it. And so for the next 7 days, they celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which actually celebrate their leaving Egypt. The Passover celebrated the point of deliverance, but the next 7 days celebrate the leaving itself, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then immediately after that, they celebrate, still in this same first month, they then celebrate what is called the Feast of First Fruits. And their year, we think of, you know, the beginning of our year is in the middle of winter, January 1st. But the beginning of their year was in late March or early April. And so they're well into spring, and the crops have already been planted by that time. And this is just about the time when the very first of their grains are making heads on their on them. And so in the celebration of the first fruits, the farmers go out into their fields and they gather up one sheaf of grain, still on the stalks, nowhere near ripe yet, but the grain is there. And it's brought in, and they celebrate this celebration of the first fruits. These are the first fruits of their harvest for that year. Even though it's not ripe yet, it's not ready to be eaten, it's going to be another 6 or 7 weeks before the actual harvest. But it's the Feast of First Fruits. And it celebrates something that hadn't even happened yet. Harvest. It's celebrating what is still 6 weeks or 7 weeks in the future for them. Most of their celebrations look back. The Feast of First Fruits look forward. And so they have these three celebrations that are very close together, all in the first month of their year. And then, after that, after 7 weeks, they then celebrate the Feast of Weeks. It's called the Feast of Weeks because it's 7 weeks. As you know, a week had 7 days for them, just like for us. But this is 7 weeks of week, you know, 7 times 7 for them. And then they celebrate the Feast of Weeks. And by that time, their crops have produced, they've harvested them, the harvest is coming to an end, and so the Feast of Weeks is actually a harvest festival, a celebration of what God has blessed them with in their harvest. Now we know it by another name, Pentecost. Pentecost. Pente meaning 50. See, 7 weeks is 49. So he said after 7 weeks, that would mean 49 days, and on the next day, the 50th day, Pentecost, they celebrate the harvest that God has given them. Again, see, to remind them how God has blessed them so abundantly. And the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, the celebration of the harvest, would happen in late May or early June by our calendar, but would be in their, I guess, their third month of their calendar. And then there's going to be a long break again before they get to their seventh month. So there's these key months for them. They have the first month and the seventh month. Three of their celebrations are in the first month. Three of them are in the seventh month. And then you have the Feast of Weeks that's sort of halfway in between them. But in the seventh month, on the first day of their seventh month, they celebrate the Feast of Trumpets. Now, before we talk about why trumpets, let's just think a moment that this is the first day of the seventh month. I hope you're already starting to pick up there's a little pattern here. Things having to do with seven. 7 days, 7 weeks, seventh month. The first day of the seventh month, they have a 1-day celebration called the Feast of Trumpets. Even today in Israel, Israel today as a nation has two calendars, besides which also having to try to accommodate the Western calendar. They have a religious calendar, which is their first month in which they celebrate Passover even today. But they also have their civil calendar. Their civil calendar, their year, civilly starts on the first day of their seventh month of their religious calendar, exactly 6 months apart from each other. Interesting, isn't it? And the Jewish people today celebrate actually the seventh month, the first day of the religious calendar as their new year today, because that begins the new business year, their new government year for them. But now, why the Feast of Trumpets? God doesn't actually tell us here in Leviticus 23 why it was to be the Feast of Trumpets. In fact, the Scriptures are a little unclear in the specifics of why the Feast of Trumpets in the Old Testament. But when we get to the New Testament, I think we'll be able to look backwards and see why. But let me suggest to you why. In Exodus chapter 19, when they come to the Mount Sinai, and they're preparing to begin this new covenant, this new relationship with God, God has Moses tell the people to purify themselves. They wash their bodies. They wash their clothes. They dedicate themselves. And on the third day, I think it was, then God says, now, on the third day, after they're all purified, they're going to come up and meet me. And they come up to the foot of the mountain. Strict boundaries have been set so they can't go past a certain point, because behind that point was sacred. But they came up to that point, and at that point, suddenly the mountain starts shaking. There's an earthquake, and there's thunder, and there's lightning, and there's smoke. God puts on a multimedia display that scared all of them to death. And in the middle of all of that, suddenly there was a loud trumpet. Nowhere are we told in the Scriptures that Moses told anybody to blow a trumpet. But somebody was blowing a trumpet. They blew it one time, and they blew it a long time. God? An angel? We're never told. But that began their encounter with God, in which they are going to be examined and judged for their sins. And then God is going to provide a way for them to have their sins forgiven. To the Jewish people, the trumpet had a lot of different meanings, but the particular trumpet that's talked about here, they use actually the word in Hebrew for the ram's horn. They also had the regular metal horns we often think of, and that's what they usually used when they went to battle and things like that. But in their religious celebrations, they always used the shofar. The ram's horn. And to the Jews, when they heard the one long blast of the ram's horn, it had two meanings that often went together. Number one, judgment. It's a time of judgment where people are going to be held accountable for their deeds. Number two, victory. Or good news. And the Jews today look at the Feast of Trumpets as those two things together. The time, first of all, where they say, we need to look at ourselves, be introspective, and say, am I right with God? And number two, celebrate victory. Good news that God has been with us this far. Because immediately after the Feast of Trumpets, some 10 days later, 9 days later, will be the Day of Atonement, in which, after having been called to account for their sins on the Day of Trumpets, they now have their sins forgiven. As the high priest makes sacrifice first for himself and then for the people, the lamb is slain, the scapegoat is taken out into the wilderness and released, all those things we've already talked about. That's the Day of Atonement. And then 5 days after that, they celebrate a week-long celebration called the Feast of Tabernacles. They use the word tabernacles to mean temporary dwelling places. And this was a time in which for 1 week they moved out of their regular houses and moved back into temporary dwellings like their ancestors had lived in for 40 years while they were in the wilderness. And they were reminded that God had been with them and had not only brought them to this good land they were in, but had kept taking care of them all during the time they lived in those temporary dwellings, those tabernacles. And they were celebrating all of these seven holidays, even in Jesus' time. I think we can find all seven of them mentioned, sometimes more than just mentioned, in the New Testament, although that's for another study. So these are the seven major holidays of the Jews. For this morning, we'll conclude by saying that for God's people, the Jews, these holidays helped indicate that they were to be a community living in celebration of their dependence, reliance, blessing, and communion, our relationship with God. Instead of thinking of them as what they sometimes appear to be in the New Testament when we run across the Sadducees and Pharisees, either like the Sadducees who seem to be totally consumed by pursuit of wealth and power, or by the Pharisees who seem to be a glum kind of somber people who are constantly worrying about, have I broken another law of God and have I looked the wrong way or done the wrong thing? They were actually supposed to be a very celebratory people, a very joyous people, that they had a relationship with God that other people did not. And they celebrated that over and over throughout their years. But more than that, in doing all of these things, God was painting a picture for them over and over again, year after year, holiday after holiday, reminding them that something even greater is coming. Something even greater is coming. Our final verse this morning, 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Paul is having to deal with the church in Corinth. They had sin in the church, and the church was not dealing with this sinful person, disciplining them and demanding that they be holy like God calls all of His people to be. And so Paul has to tell them that they need to expel this brother because of his sinfulness. Instead of being like the Corinthians are like a lot of people today, they like to take pride in the fact that they're tolerant of diversity. Well, their diversity meant they were putting up with sin in the camp. And God was not pleased with that. And so Paul says to them in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6, your boasting is not good. They were actually bragging about how tolerant they were. Don't you know that a little yeast works through the whole batch of dough? Get rid of the old yeast that you may be a new batch without yeast as you really are. Now, if I were to stop right there, I could ask you, does that sound like anything? That sounds just like the Feast of Unleavened Bread from the Old Testament. But he doesn't stop there because that's what Paul is headed towards. Listen to what he says next. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Remember, the Jewish celebration was Passover, and immediately at the end of the Passover began the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So he's linking them together here. But he's doing it in a spiritual way, isn't he? He's not talking about them keeping the old Jewish feast. He's talking about them being unleavened bread in God's house and celebrating their Passover. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the festival. Not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and wickedness, but with bread without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth. He said, let us keep the feast. Let us keep the festival. That's where we want to be today. We want to celebrate our Passover. But the only way we can do that is to be God's unleavened bread as we do it. They not only had unleavened bread that night when they ate their first Passover. Jesus took unleavened bread, as far as we know, when He instituted our communion that night before He died. And they ate unleavened bread then, and the next day, He died, our Passover lamb. And so now we celebrate our Passover. So much more to be said. Next week, with God's help, we'll look at the first four of these feasts in some detail as to how they apply to us. It's going to be a little unnerving. At least it has been for me when I first learned this several years ago in looking at these things, and it still is a little scary for me when I talk about these things. Because, you see, when the Jews were celebrating Passover, that's the day Jesus died. When the Jews were celebrating their days of unleavened bread, that's when He was in the tomb. And when they celebrated their holiday of first fruits, was the same day He rose from the dead. And as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, Christ the first fruits, talking about His resurrection, and then afterwards the rest of us. Those things didn't just happen to Jesus in a symbolic fulfillment of those things. They actually, literally, physically happen on the very days the Jews were celebrating those feasts. And 50 days later, when the Jews were ready to celebrate their Pentecost, their Feast of Weeks, the harvest time, the gospel was preached for the first time and 3,000 people became Christians. The harvest had begun. Literally, physically, on the very day. We'll talk about that more next time.